Okay, so I want to sort of shift gears. Halloween's next week. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about the paranormal. I know you're someone who, and that's I know that's a vague term, but you're a researcher who sort of focuses on UFOs. That you also understand there's this correlation between fairy realms, I don't know, ghosts. What we might sort of lump under paranormal or fantasy, that there's this sort of strange connection there. And I just want to speak specifically for a moment to the more classic paranormal experience. Is that something you deal with, or have you ever experienced something like that?
I'm not sure. My intuition and I just always seem to go back to the UFO thing. But sure, there's a the poltergeist activity is something that's reported in the homes of UFO abductees. They talk about. I
Is
mean,
that true?
oh yeah, that shows up all the time. Where what
Huh.
happened? And I asked Bud Hopkins about this when he was still alive. I talked to him in 2008 at length, and and I said, what about the poltergeist activity gets reported? And he told a story about a in the house where an abduction had occurred, and the abductee's sitting on the couch, and he's looking across, and the lamp, here we're back to lampshades again. The lamp lifts up off the coffee table next to him, rotates in the air, and then sets back down on the coffee table upside down.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, and then I had a I've spoke to one woman. And she talked about the gray aliens. She's a fascinating person. She's had, an amazing experience. She's super funny and articulate about the way she writes about them. She has a blog called At Spiral's End. That's amazing. But she told a story where this one I always go back to. The little gray aliens are notorious for just opening a interdimensional doorway and just walking right through the walls and ending up in the house, and they're sort of caring and without emotions. Now, she also has had experiences with the tall Nordics, or the blondes, as they're sometimes called. And what they'll do is they'll land their flying saucer, a few hundred yards away from the house, and then they'll walk right up to the door and actually knock on the door and turn the doorknob and walk in. And she has a story, she has stories of both. And she says her hypothesis is the reason they do that is because the nearly human Nordic blondes recognize that the mechanism of coming into our reality opens up this window, this rift, and then like odd poltergeist experience come rushing through that open window. So when the blondes are polite enough that they don't want to invade someone's house with, weird apparitions and poltergeists and orbs and creaky noises and stuff. So they'll land their flying saucer, away from the house, where the grays will just open up a doorway and just walk right through the wall. And then when that happens, all kinds of other stuff rush through that same open window,
Yes.
and that it's this odd parallel dimensional stuff that we can't quite wrap our minds around. We're just odd things will start happening. TV sets will turn on and off, faucets will turn on and off. All these stories are completely the norm in the realm of the abductee.
Okay, so, well, huh? You've just thrown me for a loop here because, after I spoke to you last year, after I spoke to you last year, you had sort of posed the question about UFOs, and I said, it's something I have a mild interest in up to that point. And this sort of memory came back to me afterwards that my brother and I used to always have this thing where on certain nights, sometimes in the winter, the sky will glow kind of pinkish red. This sort of snow glare. I don't know, maybe that's New York pollution or if that's everywhere, but it's very common in the winter for the sky to glow reddish pink. I mean, bright reddish pink here. So again, I don't know if that's true everywhere, if that's our air pollution. But my brother and I used to always refer to this as children. We used to always refer to this as the UFO sky. Like, when the night looked like that, we would say to each other, oh, it's the UFO sky tonight. And this sort of phrase came back to me and said, why did we call it that? So the reason I wanted to ask you about the paranormal, I was going to ask you about poltergeists specifically. So, but it's only in my mother's house. I mean, I've lived in many different places since then, and I've never had experiences like I had in the house I grew up in. And what's so interesting you say about coming through the wall, as a child, my bed was up against this wall, and then there was a window in the next room over. It was a very small apartment, so there was no door between them, so it's technically the next room, but there's a window. And when I would see that sky, I was never worried about something coming through the window. It was, I had this weird irrational fear of something coming through the wall. And I had this thing that I was always worried something was going to come through the wall while I was sleeping there. And the best thing I could chalk it up to, psychoanalyzing myself, was that I had watched, you ever see the movie Silver Bullet? It was like this werewolf movie. And at the end of the movie, like, they think they're safe in the place, and the werewolf comes bursting through the door, which, of course, wolves and alien contact go hand in hand, both with Whitley Strieber and my own crazy wolf serious experiences. It's just so entwined for me. Wolves and aliens seems to be just the same thing. Of course, the grays, right? The gray wolf. Regardless, in that apartment, the experiences that I had as a small child were what would be considered poltergeist experiences. I remember one time that my mom, she was a single mom, she said, I just have to run to the post office. You know, I was basically, I don't know, probably like 6 or 7, and I'm playing with these action figures on the floor. And she says, like, listen, I just have to run out for 1 minute, just lock the door behind me, and I'll be right back, you'll be fine. So I said, okay. So I get up, and I turn my back to the action figures. My mom leaves, I lock the door, and when I turn back around, all the action figures are standing up in a semicircle around me, like positioned neatly in this semicircle around me, standing facing me, and I just freaked out. It was this total Toy Story experience, and I just kind of freaked out. And now I saw that as perhaps my fear of being left alone in that moment manifested something. But I had this other experience that I still know the person. I was dating this girl at the time. I still speak to her on occasion. We remained friendly over the years. And I was in college dating this girl, and it's late at night, and I'm on the phone with her. My family's asleep, and I'm just on the phone with this girl, and we're just talking, and I'm sitting on the couch, and what happens? The lamp next to me was this turning, like those old school lamps where you had to like twist the dial and it made this loud click noise, and you actually had to turn it twice to make it go on. And I'm sitting there, and suddenly I hear click, click, and the light goes out. And then it's click, click, and the light goes on. And it wasn't like, you know, just a bulb flashing. And then the TV turns off and turns on. And then, and then I go, oh my God. And so I run out of the room, and I go into the other room, and the light switch literally flips up and flips down, flips up, flips down. And I'm on the phone with this girl. I'm like going, you don't understand. This is the craziest shit that has ever happened to me. What the fuck's going on? And she's like, oh, it's probably just, you know, the electrics, things are blinking on and off. I'm like, no, the switch is moving. So she finally convinces me to calm down. I go back into the room where I was with the lamp and the TV. I go back in that room, and I'm sitting there. I'm like, okay. And I'm like, no. I was like, you don't understand. It was actually clicking and turning. And she's like, well, maybe it just made a click sound because of the electrics. So now, in that room is a ceiling fan, like this like light fixture with ceiling fan that has these two different metal chains. You know, you pull one for the light or pull one for the fan. And as I'm sitting there and she's trying to convince me it's just electrics, I watch as the chain literally pulls down, and it makes the loud click, clink, and the light goes off. And it pulls down and goes click, clink, and the light goes on. And I'm just like, no, this is not electrics. Something is fucking with me.
Wow. So what you're describing is classic poltergeist stuff. I mean, just lights going on and off. And yeah, so that's so interesting. And it's interesting that the lampshade shows up in here again.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I never connected those before this. But what I said, to me, I kind of went to the poltergeist answer, if you will, as the best explanation, because it was in that house only. Again, I've lived in many other apartments, and I've never had experiences like that anywhere else except in that house. So
is there an interventional doorway where stuff is slipping in and out? Sure.
Wow.
So here, like, one more lampshade story. So recently this young woman showed up at my place. She's actually very interesting also. Her name is Karis Brown, and she wrote a book called A Journal of a Star Seed and I think Diary of a Star Seed. Two books, and one of them is channeled, and she's had all these strange experiences. She's now working as a psychic, and which is very common among people who claim the abduction lore to then be a psychic. So we were talking about trying to start a little camping thing where I teach camping. But anyway, so she showed up. This was late in the summer. So I picked her up late at night at the airport and drove her home, and she was going to sleep on the couch. And we're sitting in the room, and we're both pretty amped up. It's like we're talking, mile a minute, both of us, about experiences. And she comes in the house, and I'm sitting in my desk chair, and she's sitting in another chair facing me. And behind her, I'm in the office right now, and I'm looking at the lampshade. Behind her, and I'm pretty sure it was right when she said the words alien abduction or abduction or something in that that was definitely, there was like an audible click on the lampshade. And it sounded like it's one of those paper lampshades. And you know how when a moth, just think of a big fat moth, like zooming in and like flies right in and hits the lampshade. And there's this kind of that, it's not really loud, but you would hear it, but that kind of thunk, that click noise.
Sure, yeah.
And so she turns her head and looks at the lampshade. I did too. I was like, it just made a noise. And I said, oh, that's a moth, flew into it. And then we both stood there, and the moth season had kind of ended. There wouldn't really been moths in the house at that time of year. And we both stared at the light, and there was no moth. And I was actually looking right at the light when I heard the noise, and there was no moth there. So one more little odd thing that has to do with lampshades.
Is that the Mothman or lack thereof?
Good. I didn't even catch that one, yeah.
Huh. Wow, I'm going to be thinking about lampshades for the next few weeks. That's really interesting.
Huh. And that, in like in Mad Magazine, sort of like 1960s lore, when someone got drunk at a party, they would put a lampshade on their head. So,
there's a sign of intoxication. I hope this doesn't discredit my other experiences, because these were when I was younger, before ever taking any hallucinogens. But the most powerful drug-induced hallucination I ever had was from a lampshade as well. I remember I was, it was a weekend of taking a series of psychedelics and long, stupid things that you put in your body. And then I was living in this apartment, and this girl I was dating, she's going to sleep. We're all exhausted from taking too many drugs, and she's going to sleep. And suddenly I look over at the lampshade that's there, and the lamp turns into this giant, relatively, it was still the size of the lamp. The lamp turned into this glowing mushroom, symbolic of psychedelics in itself, but the lamp turned into a mushroom, and then all this grass grew on the floor, and I suddenly had this, I'm having this freak out that I'm a 50-foot tree, and if I move, I'm going to knock the apartment over. I've never had any experience like this, and she's just sitting there going, you're not a tree, go to bed. Very unsympathetic. You're not a tree, go to bed. I'm like, no, you don't understand. If I move, I'm going to knock the whole apartment over. But it was the single most memorable and intense hallucination I've ever had, again, with lampshade. I just had to throw that out there.
So the verse that you mentioned earlier with from the gospel about the lampshade business was actually the Lamsa interpretation, which is considered, he was a scholar, it's considered pretty authoritative, especially with how he was raised and his early background being very similar to the time of the gospels. Like, it's one of the few areas that carried on the same, whatever. Anyways, his interpretation is that it has to do with hoarding. And the fact that when people would have lamps, that they would often, because people live so close together, would want to keep it for themselves and their own families. and not want other people getting something out of the light that would come through, you know, the windows and whatnot. They wanted that covered. That's why it's a whole house on a hill thing. And so I can't help, but I was having a conversation yesterday with my girlfriend about the Catholic Church, its use of psychedelic mushrooms, and how there's this theory of that the if you look at the old uniforms of the authoritative people in the church, that there's very much resonant with like Amanita muscaria, and how, and I was, we were talking about how it is that some people who have experienced psychedelic, whatever, you know, they have that experience and they can't imagine how somebody after the fact or within the fact could somehow generate the kind of energetic of that, of actually literally hoarding, as you know, the implication is like you have a church that's the wealthiest, they're the biggest property owners in the world, McDonald's second to them, you know, the Catholic Church, you know, and it's like, wow, people who, you know, at the, like, how could that happen? Like, and it's like that people relate to the thing, they bring their own energetic to the thing, and it doesn't really, like, I mean, you're not just going to be like peace and love because you take this thing. It doesn't translate that way. And so I could definitely kind of run with that idea of like the lampshade being like to hoard the light, basically to have the light all to yourself, and how that translates in terms of the church with its use of psychedelics.
Yeah. I mean, this has been fascinating, just going down. I mean, like the lampshade thing is just like, you know, something as benign and kind of, you know, easily dismissed as, you know, bringing up all these interesting stories and speculation.
I don't have a single lampshade in my apartment.
I have one in mine.
I don't have a single lampshade in my apartment.
I actually don't either. That's funny.
I guess I'm not hoarding, or I just very, very lazy and have very bad style, but probably a mixture of all that. You ever notice when you go into like a good Catholic church, or if you're in a Catholic university in the library, oftentimes there'll be a stained glass window, or like along the side of the building, it'll be a perfect circle, right? And inside the circle will be this ornate design, oftentimes not necessarily depicting anything religious. It's just, you know, a stained glass window, just many different shapes and colors. And oftentimes, and I've seen this in a couple of different libraries specifically, though they may not have been initially built as libraries, but if you look upon them from a certain angle, looking up, the way that they're cut into the side of the wall and the way that the light projects out of it, and if you kind of allow your eyes to sort of relax and not necessarily, you know, that whole reading, when you read a book, you focus in a certain way and you lift up and that's how you kind of see the world. If you just sort of relax your eyes and allow the whole field of vision to sort of become one, the way that that circle sort of jumps out of the wall. And it kind of hovers there in a very defined way that separates itself from everything else in your field of vision. And because of the colors and because of the lights, I mean, it's a goddamn UFO. I mean, it's just hovering there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, churches and libraries are places of meditation and places where often a person would gaze and kind of lose themselves into that sort of hypnagogic reverie. And possibly that sort of artwork that just seemingly becomes part of church architecture and is a stained glass window, that if there is a possibility that there was any intent or a fraction of it was intentional, I mean, those kinds of windows become these saucer-shaped floating objects that have just brilliant and dazzling colors that just sort of hypnotize the mind and put it into maybe not the beta state that the television does, but it puts you in some sort of mental place. And the way that that clarity jumps out through everything else is astonishing and beautiful. It's a shame that a lot of the way people look at churches is so tainted because of the way it was corporatized and it was screwed up. But I was just wondering if anyone else has had that kind of revelation with those stained glass windows, or what your thoughts to that kind of line of thinking is.
If I may quickly address that, the round stained glass windows in churches are typically referred to as Catherine wheels.
Okay. And,
oh, I didn't know that. Oh, that's
and that's a big part of the book that I'm writing, and I mean that's what I keep. It's this weird sort of corollary to the ego death that I keep harping on is that wherever there's a sort of ego death, higher consciousness, etc., you'll almost always find a Catherine wheel in the same scenario. It's this sort of corollary. And those circular, essentially mandala, stained glass mandalas in churches are referred to as Catherine wheels.
Huh. I keep thinking about Santa Claus, actually. Not to get too out there, but Santa Claus's outfit reminds me of the Amanita muscaria.
That's very common in the red and white color scheme. Yeah, shows up all
totally.
The time.
And then you have obviously Saint Nicholas, and but then you have the fact that Amanita was eaten by reindeer, who people would drink the snow that the reindeer would piss in to get as a way to filter the Amanita, so to actually be less intense, and that was actually like a common practice. And how odd it is that Santa Claus here is riding through the sky behind reindeer. Also, Santa is an anagram for Satan, which is interesting in and of itself. But then how his outfit parallels the Catholic Church outfits, and I don't know.
Don't you find it also interesting that Santa comes in through a passageway that he shouldn't be able to? Essentially,
right.
Like a gray alien would come through, is coming through a chimney which he doesn't actually fit through, essentially opening a doorway.
Yeah, absolutely, and how it's this big brother thing of how he sees everyone, but no one sees him, and how basically he's all about morality and naughty and nice, and how that's like an extension of the idea of the church. It's like this all-seeing eye kind of thing is what Santa actually is, and how that's the earliest like programming for children in terms of getting their imagination and a way of relating to the world. It's this character, and how it's completely like basically this one day out of the year is supposed to resolve everything. It's like this, I don't know, it's a very, very strange deal. But then I just can't help, I keep finding like these weird parallels with the church and the whole alien thing, with like the biggest sculpture at the Catholic Church is this giant pine cone, like with these sphinxes in front of it. Like it's just I keep having this flash from the film Communion, actually. I never read the book, but where Christopher Walken sees this gray take off his face, and there's this reptile behind it, and just what a, and then he's like, no, that's not it. That's not it. Like he's like, I'm curious as to what this whole thing is. It's like this really kind of weird puzzle to do, like with the reptilian and the alien and of the classic gray and all of this stuff. It's just very strange.
Well, you have the reptilian, you have the gray, and you have the Aryan, or this Nordic figure, right?
Well, okay, so this is a story that I don't often share, and I feel weird about recording it, but I feel like as briefly as possible, I just want to express this. I have a very close friend who I trust, whatever, he shared something with me, and it had a pretty big impact on me. I think I shared it with you, Alan, at the Sink Cabin this last year. But basically, he was very close with this woman who he went off to her property over along the Truckee River, and she had this huge property. And basically, it turns out that her father is the son of the Learjet, and he struck him. Oh, her last name's Lear, and whatever. Anyways, he meets the son of the inventor of the Learjet, and he shares with him this book that's basically this military astronaut book that is all about aliens. And he spent 20 minutes looking through this book and he just couldn't believe what he was looking at. But basically it starts out just like, you know, obviously from the assumption that aliens are a fact. And if you encounter such and such a being, this is how to deal with it and whatnot. And like just very matter of fact. And it basically, as I recall his explanation, he said that there was three different types of aliens that it talks about in this book, and that the gray alien that we know of is actually an organic suit that's not actually an alien in and of itself. It's just this like life tissue that's generated by this being as a way to communicate with us, because these are actually interdimensional beings that don't have a form as we relate to form. And that basically that's what this is a suit. And, you know, I mean, whatever, if you buy this or not, you know, I mean, the fact is that there, according to my friend, who I believe, there was this book and this is what it said. And so I don't know. I feel like that's worth mentioning here.
And that would be, was that John Lear? John Lear is he's a sort of well-known character within the UFO field, and he's the pilot he must be in his early 70s now, but he is very famous and very like, he's got some pretty wild out there ideas and concepts, and he's kind of he's kind of a little bit dismissed as in the UFO field as being, you know, not a credible character.
Well, he was so basically, if it's the son of the inventor of the Learjet, I don't know enough.
That would
about.
Be John Lear. Yeah. That's got to be who it is. Yeah.
Like just walking around her house and he just sees this man shaking the hands of all of these people, all these presidents and all of these officials. And he's just like, who is this guy? You know, and then they're walking along and she's like, oh, would you like to meet my father? And he ended up putting it together. He's like, oh, you're Lear. Oh, shit. You're OK. But then I also wanted to mention here. OK, I'm going to put up a link right now really quickly of just this keeps coming up. And I don't know. I'm really curious of your thoughts on it, of just this idea that you have this government UFO that supposedly Project Paperclip and the Nazis were trying to build these UFOs and that we succeeded. And then that's supposedly like a lot of what was going on in Area 51, which is like basically creating this saucer. And supposedly this is declassified. There's actually this UFO that the saucer that the government built. Can you see this image?
Oh, there's images from like the 50s and 60s of saucer shaped craft that who knows what they were, you know, just some little odd thing that they built at at some test ground or something.
Recent photograph that I just set up a link to that I'm curious about it, how legit it is or what the deal is. But I mean, I don't know. I was very, very, very strange. I mean, it doesn't discount the idea that like they could be modeling this off of another thing that they found or something, you know. It's just but apparently our government built these saucers. I don't know. I think it's very strange.
Well, yeah, there's oh gosh, this is a bottomless pit once you get into the weird government stuff. I mean, because things are going, you know, one thing, there could be an element of truth to it, and there's probably is some element of truth to it, and then where that is, who knows? Because I always think of like the best job in the Pentagon would be the guy that sits in the basement and is like tasked with like messing with the UFO community, you know, because all he has to do is get an old typewriter, write up something, you know, find the guy that can do Harry Truman's signature. So he writes up some, you know, crazy document and then, you know, does it on old paper and then releases it to the UFO community, and the UFO community goes nuts and then spends years like, you know, arguing and fighting over this piece of paper. And, yeah. And when you get right down to it, it's just a piece of paper. And so there's a lot of, so I have a hard time with the government researchers just because it's so fraught with disinformation. You would think that, you know, if, and I'm quite certain with all the zillions of dollars that are being spent, you know, and there are, you know, top secret Air Force bases, you know, they're probably testing and experimenting with things that we would look at and say, well, that's an unconventional aircraft. And then, you know, so they're all for spreading the rumors that, you know, UFOs are part of the overall scene at Area 51, because when you stand on a hill outside of Area 51 and look through binoculars, you know, people do get a glimpse of these odd lights and odd craft moving in unconventional ways. And you know, who knows what's going on there? Is it alien technology? Is it a bunch of smart people that have been working for 60 years with $1 trillion a year as a budget, you know, coming up with amazing classified, you know, technologies? So, yeah, so that one is a bottomless pit. I don't even know where to begin with that stuff. I have certainly heard all the stories. Some of the stories are compelling. You know, authors like Richard Dolan make a very dry, formal case that is the case, that there have been recovered alien technologies and those are being used in secret projects. But yeah, I have no idea what's, you know, which end is up when you get right down to this stuff.
Okay. Yeah, that's kind of the answer I sort of expected.
No, so a couple things. So one thing is that, you know, perhaps a percentage of what is being seen now, and especially when you think about drone technologies, you know, these and there's these little hobby kits you can get, these funny little things that are disc shaped and they have little helicopter you know, blades on the inside, and they actually fly around. They look just like little cute flying saucers. You know, you can just buy these at a hobby shop. So very much so, some of the things that are reported by witnesses, you know, that see something in the sky that's acting strangely, doesn't look like a normal helicopter or a normal airplane, could be technologies that just haven't been released to the public, that are just, yeah. But what happens is then you turn the clock back and people were seeing strange UFOs in the 1950s, and late 1940s. Were they seeing, you know, so that, you know, the technology would not have been there at that point for them to see these top secret government things that look like flying saucers.
Right. Yeah, my friends do an event at NASA here near San Jose. That basically they'd bring out the shuttle and we would set up speakers all around and have this giant, basically a rave at the NASA place, and all these NASA people would come to it, and they had all sorts of flying saucers that they had going over the crowd. You look over the crowd and you see these little discs floating around. But what interests me more than whatever the hell they were using to float those things is the idea of superfluids and circulating superfluids in order to basically defy gravity through that process, which I just find totally fascinating kind of idea. I don't know.
There's an author named Mark Davenport. He wrote a book called Visitors from Time. And he proposed, there's all these odd things that get reported in the UFO field, you know, like the flying saucers will change color. It's very common for them to go through the spectrum and change color. And it's also very common when people are close to flying saucers, or let's say alien craft, or being influenced by this sort of entities from an unknown origin, that there will be an odd quiet, like a hyper quiet, it's sometimes referred to as the Oz factor. Suddenly things become more quiet than quiet. And if so if the propulsion system actually distorts time, I don't know who knows what the propulsion system is, you know, spinning, you know, liquids in a, you know, who knows, you know, antimatter. But so somehow or another, they're changing time. So imagine, so the Earth is twirling and we're spinning around in space, and, you know, so everything's in motion. So all you have to do if you're the pilot of a craft is just distort time just a little bit, and then the craft will zoom off into a direction. You know, if you had supercomputers, you could figure out the trajectory you'd want to go, and then the craft would distort time correctly, either just a little bit forward, just a little bit back. So if there's things that take place in the UFO reports, like the quiet. So imagine if time is distorted in a field around the UFO, the one of the effects would be, so like, you know, we can only hear a certain spectrum of the sine wave, of the sound waves. So that, you know, that looks like, if you put it on a computer screen, it's a sine wave. If you distort that sine wave just slightly, it immediately will disappear from our range of hearing. So you would experience, the probability is that you would experience a weird kind of quiet that you've never experienced before, because time is distorted. The sound wave that is how sound reacts to time would be distorted. And another thing that's also very commonly reported, so if you did have to a travel in this machine that's distorting time, you may not be able to just make a nice straight line. Like in a sailboat on the water, you know, you can't just sail against the wind, but you can tack against the wind. You can make a zigzag pattern and mm-hmm. then use the wind that way. So what is reported very commonly is a falling leaf motion. Like a flying saucer doesn't land, for the most part, the way reports are, it doesn't land like the beginning of the day the Earth stood still. You know, like you can just, any kid can take a plate and just like make it land nice and smoothly, like they would suspect a flying saucer to land. They generally aren't reported as landing like that. They'll land in a falling leaf motion, which in a way is that tacking motion if you're distorting time. And they'll also take off in a stair step motion.
The vacuum of space, basically, if they're going to travel long distances like they're supposed to. So
that was a long-winded answer, but yeah, so there's all these odd things that get reported. And that one book, Visitors from Time, by this author Mark Davenport, also, if I'm understanding this correctly, he's since died, but like that he was an alien abductee, a UFO abductee.
I don't know if we're winding down here, but there was something that I want to definitely get in here. You know, Mike, when I was doing the Sync Book 2, I thought it was really important that your voice be in there, because there is this strange correlation between UFOs and synchronicity, that you are the sort of go-to guy for this correlation. But I've seen, Nick Redfern had mentioned something along those lines, that there should be a UFO conference should have something about talking about synchronicity and UFOs, this correlation. Obviously, this is a big thing within that community, but it's not really getting highlighted. Regardless, as a guy from the synchronicity side of things, I see that this other, let's call it other, very often doesn't get touched. Or if it does get touched, it gets completely blown into this frightened, dark, reptilian quagmire that I'm not really interested in. So anyway, I thought it was really important that voice be in there. And what's sort of funny to me, I'm still, of course, incredibly happy to have your piece in there. It does it so well. But what's really funny to me is that all these other people that don't normally write about these subjects, when I said write about synchronicity, there are multiple chapters where people addressed either aliens or some sort of external entity or disincarnate intelligence. David, even your chapter where you talk about the Moonchild, in the Babylon working, is essentially a discarnate entity, interdimensional beings, that same sort of thing. And sure. So it's not exactly like everyone's writing about UFOs, but there seems to be this sort of overarching theme of contact with something. Again, someone wrote a chapter about Quetzalcoatl. Someone's writing about UFOs. Someone's writing about a moon child. Someone's writing about archons or Gnostic deities. There is this sort of overarching. I really, really took me by surprise that I did not expect this book to take the shape. And yet, I can't help but realize that here we are on the cusp of 2012, December 21st, 2012, which I don't really put credence into, but I only mention it in there is to say, what does this say about our current zeitgeist, if you will, that people seem to be focused in on this aspect, on contact with the other?
I obviously am like seeing everything through the lens of like, you know, the UFO phenomenon and more specifically the, you know, abduction lore, which is kind of what I'm drawn to. So I'm guilty of like, you know, having those glasses on, and that's all, you know, like everything is related to that, you know, so I can find correlations to that everywhere. So, you know, that was easy for me to write that. I got a little, I posted some stuff on Facebook yesterday when I put that article on my site, and you know, one person kind of said, she said, you know, I read the article, but, you know, like, you could go to a writer's conference and people could be talking about synchronicities, which is true. But I'm like, whatever, I'm guilty of seeing that in that realm. And part of that is just because, you know, when I go to UFO conferences and ask people, like, well, what do you think of the synchronicities? They'll literally like roll their eyes in the back of their head and, you know, sort of like just make this expression of like, oh my God, it's beyond berserk, you know, the synchronicities that show up in my life. So, you know, I don't know what the zeitgeist is. You know, it's certainly sort of ever present in my, you know, the stacks of papers, you know, on my desk right now, because that's what I'm digging into. But why is it showing up in other people's? I mean, the thought is, one is that, you know, it is a reality that there is some sort of influence from beyond, and it's just taking different forms. You know, one of the things that I dismissed initially is when people would see fairies. And then I've heard enough stories about people seeing fairies, and they all sort of describe them the same way, that I'm like, huh, I can't dismiss that anymore, because they're seeing something. So is all paranormal phenomena just like a under one big giant meta umbrella, and it's all just being done by these tricksters that are just beyond our, these tricksters, whether intelligences, whether those are little beings or just like, you know, just a mystical energetic presence, you know, I think we are, I know I'm sensing this stuff in our popular culture and in, you know, going on. So, you know, why wouldn't everyone else be sensing it? You know, just maybe wearing a different costume when they describe what they're interacting with or their thoughts.
What do you think the role of a show like The X-Files played? That was hugely popular, critically acclaimed, and seemed to really kind of dive deep into the lore. Do you think that's a positive or a negative, or just a naturally occurring phenomenon of our time?
Well, Christopher Knowles is the much better person to answer this question, that question. Cause you know, like I kind of prefer, I didn't start watching the X-Files until after the show had been on for a number of years. And I don't have a television reception where I live. So I watched them all on, you know, the video store near my house had them on VHS. And that's how I started watching them. But it's my understanding that the script writers for the X-Files had in their, you know, like they had a room, like a library just filled with UFO books, and the script writers would go into the room, open the UFO books and get ideas. So there you have a situation where the phenomena comes first, and then the you know, they are gleaning, they're mining that phenomena, you know, through, you know, plagiarizing things, stealing things from books, and then inserting those into the story. And it, you know, makes perfect sense, right? There's a wealth of information. The information is weird and creepy, and so. It seemed like the phenomena was feeding the show. There's a lot of folks that will say like, oh, you know, this is all in response to the X-Files. People are, you know, making this stuff up just because they saw it on TV. And it's almost the other way around.
It's like Law and Order ripped from the headlines sort of deal.
Sure. I mean, I could, you know, I can point to the cases that show up in the X-Files, you know, where they, you know, were like, oh, that's obviously from these reports here. And the X-Files had its own mythology, you know.
Okay, you wrote an article just a few weeks ago talking about these older films, though, and TV shows, and you referred to it as, you didn't use the expression predictive programming, but you did say something about predictive. You would know better than I. What was the phrase you used? I thought it was. I just wanted to know, how do you view that? Was that in the classic, almost conspiracy sense of predictive programming, or predictive in the true sense of here's something that was written about, fictionalized, and then it happened?
Well, scenario. There's an author named Richard Matheson, and he wrote a story in 1953. I didn't know that he wrote the story because he wrote a short story. And then that short story was turned into a movie in 1974. It's almost 21 years later. And the movie, that's what I remember. So I remember as a little kid in 1974 watching this movie, and it had to do with Barbara Eden, who played Jeannie in I Dream of Jeannie, and she plays like a suburban housewife, and she's mysteriously pregnant, and her husband has had a vasectomy. It's kind of rare for the time, how did she get pregnant? She's obviously cheating. So there's all these, she's pleading, she's saying she's been totally faithful to her husband. But what it turns out to be is an alien baby, and it's in it, and it had so many parallels to the present day literature. And I went through, and being really familiar, having read the ridiculous number of books I've read, that the story, the movie was called The Stranger Within, the 1974 made for TV movie. And what I did is I got it. I just ordered it online, and a DVD arrived at my house, and I watched it, and I was shocked at how clearly I remembered it from being a little kid. And I kept a notepad, and I was writing down all this stuff, and I was like, oh God, this thing shows up in the literature too. And then after seeing the movie, I did a little research, and it was based on a 1953 story. So I got the story. I just ordered it on Kindle, and within minutes of, clicking the thing, I was reading it online. And, so the same author, Richard Matheson, who's done a ton, he's still alive. He's 86 years old, and he wrote for Twilight Zone. He wrote for Steven Spielberg. He's the guy that wrote the Duel story. That's what I mentioned earlier. But in that sense, my thought is that some sort of collective consciousness, so he was able to tap into this sort of future consciousness in a way that a creative person would do. It happened in 1953 when he was writing tons and tons of short stories and cranking them out for these pulp sci-fi magazines. So, was he just in a creative frenzy and just was so open to the creative process that this stuff just welled up from, whatever, I don't know, whatever term you want to use the noosphere, that it was, what was he tapping into? But I don't think that it was a conspiracy, a government conspiracy. And I don't think that he was an abductee or had a friend who was an abductee, because just reading the literature, like the stuff that he was tapping into didn't show up in any sort of reporting, even when people would like now look back and say, oh, I had this thing, it took place back then. They don't go back to 1953. If you look at the timeline, they just go back to perhaps the late 70s. So I don't
What
know. I get.
was the year that like Leary and Robert Anton Wilson and Terrence McKenna, all these guys claimed the contact from Sirius?
Yeah, 1974. There's also
Same year that this movie came out.
Lily never claimed. Did he claim Sirius?
No, Lily didn't. I don't think Lily did. Lily's thing was Echo.
Yeah,
He
Robert
said.
Anton Wilson claimed Sirius.
Right.
Yes. So did
But I
Lily.
wasn't saying Lily, I was saying Leary, as in Timothy Leary. Timothy
Not.
Leary, Ram Dass, Philip K. Dick. I'm sorry, Ram Dass, Jesus. Robert Anton Wilson, Timothy Leary, Robert Anton Wilson, Philip K. Dick. And I believe Terrence McKenna all claimed contact from Sirius.
And then John Lilly, who was part of that kind of mystical crowd, was taking ketamine. That was, he wasn't taking LSD, he was taking another drug. And he claimed to hear disincarnate voices that were communicating with him from another realm. So that also took place in 1974, but he didn't say it originated in Sirius. And if I'm not mistaken, there's a science fiction writer named Dorothy. Oh, I'm going to draw. I'll think of her name in a second. Lessing, Doris Lessing. She claimed the same thing, and that's I have not looked into that. This is just something that a researcher named Adam Gorightly told me, that she also fits into that weird triad of, whatever, like four or five people that were part of this progressive psychedelic scene that then said they were being communicated to through Sirius. And that's a very interesting that 1974 shows up in my stuff, and maybe I'm just hyper correct, or excuse me, hyper aware of 1974 just because of the weirdness and of what's shown up in that year. I see it reoccurring over and over and over again that year.
Well, that's the year of Watergate, isn't it?
You know, I'm not sure if it was the year of Watergate or the year of the Watergate.
The year the story broke.
No, I think that's the year. That's the year that Nixon was resigned, wasn't it? 74.
Okay, so check this out. So I know Watergate obviously is like water door or Stargate. You know, I guess I didn't say this earlier today, but 2001: A Space Odyssey comes out the very day that Martin Luther King was shot.
Kidding.
No. So you have, again, the King kill goes hand in hand with this sort of, you know, consciousness leap. But, I was mentioning before the connections between the atomic bombs and JFK. See, now my lack of sleep's catching up with me. Nixon resigned, I believe, on August 9th, the same day of the Nagasaki bombing.
Huh. No, I remember it was in August. I remember being a little kid and like being riveted to the
I'm like 99.99% sure that Nixon resigns on the same day as the Nagasaki bombing, August 9th.
Well, that would be easy. Up, yeah.
So and
my weird like this thing, this the evolutionary triad, which is the name of the essay, which had all these connections with 2001. That whole thing kind of culminates in the assassination of. What's her name? The woman in Gabrielle Giffords, the woman in the woman Congress.
Yes, very much. Very, very much. You and I discussed this, and there's the Dr. Dave Bowman on the scene at the Gabrielle Giffords shooting.
And then who attends to Christina Taylor Greene, who's a 9-year-old girl who was born on September 11th, 2001.
You mentioned before Kim Hunter. Do you know what day Kim Hunter died?
No.
September 11th.
Oh my gosh! Kim Hunter was in a radio drama called the CBS Radio Mystery Theater, and she was in something called The Sighting, where she played a UFO abductee, and that was in broadcast in November of 1974. So here we have 1974. Kim Hunter. You know, resonating the UFO abductee.
And what if the fact, I mean, this we're kind of like going spiderweb here again, but you mentioned Barbara Eden, I Dream of Jeannie. And I Dream of Jeannie, she's, of course, a genie or a djinn, right? She's this elemental spirit, however you want to look at that. And what is her husband? But he works for NASA.
He works for NASA and is keeping a secret, is, you know, a secret from everyone. Yeah, so and then Gabrielle Giffords' husband is an astronaut, and identical twin brother was in space at the time on the Endeavor, which was the name of the ship that Dave Bowman was in 2001.
Endeavor, no, Discovery, right?
Was it Discovery? Okay, excuse Discovery.
Jeannie too. I've just been thinking of I Dream of Jeannie. Kind of weird. I just watched the same guy who did Napoleon Dynamite did another movie, something Broncos. It's all about science fiction geeks and science fiction writing of books. And I noticed that his mom gets dressed up as I Dream of Jeannie at one point, or the woman from I Dream of Jeannie. And I was thinking about Jeannie, literally, like basically, it's the same root word as genius. And the way that people used to relate to the genie is literally it's the higher self. It's like the idea of another within you, which is, you know, when I've had come out of sleep paralysis in the past, especially when I really release into it and really just let go and then finally come out of it and feel like I could have been gone, you know, 10 years or 5 minutes. I have a terrifying sense of another, just the idea of other is just extremely just terrifying. And so I've always kind of found that interesting in relationship to the idea of a genie and the idea of being basically afraid of your higher self, and how maybe the ego itself as a with its autonomy as like a holographic substitute for that self as an aversion to being in contact with that is kind of like basically it's held there out of fear. I don't know. It's just some thoughts.
And then, you know, obviously the we're back to the lamp again. That's where the genie, which came from a bottle.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, a TV show, but the, you know, the Aladdin, the genie comes from a lamp.
Right.
Huh. So I just verified, yes, Kim Hunter died September 11, 2002, so 1 year after 9/11.
Huh.
Huh. So, yeah, and then Christina Taylor Greene would have been 1 year old and the day of her death. And then, you know, Taylor is obviously the name of Charlton Heston from Planet of the Apes. So
right.
Here you Dave Bowman coming to rescue someone named Taylor. And then, you know, Christina, I just listened to the podcast that you and I did, Alan, and you know, Christina is, you know, Christ, and then Green is Osiris. So you have, you know, Taylor being bookended in her name by, you know, Christ and Green.
Who is Charlton Heston but Moses?
And who, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, he's so easy. I mean, he's had so many, you know, he meets Jesus in Ben-Hur and everything like that. So
yeah.
He's an easy one to make all kinds of connections with. And then he was in Richard Matheson's the adaption of I Am Legend, which was the Omega Man. So
right.
which was a story, a novel based on called I Am Legend by Richard Matheson. Hey, here, I just want to like say, Alan, I just listened to that podcast we did a little less than a year ago, and I you know, I just got to say that was one of the most sort of optimistic kind of powerful things that I'd ever done on this, you know, like you talk about UFOs and stuff, it can be dark and creepy. And I thought that one was, you know, just talking about synchronicities and the power of synchronicities. Like I just recently listened to that and I was kind of blown away by how, you know, mystical we got as well as how like life affirming that was. So I just want to thank you. Cause that one almost had a life of its own. I remember when we were recording it, I wanted to end it. You know, I was like, oh shit, I don't want to screw this up. You know, like we go for another 5 minutes and someone might mention a downer or something like that, you know? And so thanks. That was great.
Oh, same here. Yeah, that was a big one for me. I mean, you know, I was in a period where I'm getting asked to do these sort of, you know, almost, you know, you end up in this sort of promotional state for the book or something. And that's just really contrary to my nature. You know, I sort of took on that role of like, okay, someone needs to like go out and actually do some of the legwork promoting this project. But that was a completely different experience for me. And I think that's because of the environment that you set up there. And I just felt completely... It was so natural and welcoming that it was just very easy to just be open and be honest. And so that was a really big turning point for me that I did that show with you. And I was just like, it was positive and life affirming for me as well. And just sort of that's what keeps me into it. The promotional stuff is really a drag, actually. It's not really pleasant. It's not really work that I enjoy. But to actually get to just sit down and dissect these ideas with someone who's also fascinated by it. And that's why I really like this format of what we do here is just talk, throw some ideas out, find other people that are into it, that are also exploring these things, and just discuss it and find a sort of friendship there that you don't often get or is very unexpected when it happens. And I really appreciated that show. It meant a lot to me. So I'm glad it meant something to you as well.
Oh yeah. That's one of my favorites that I've done.
Wrap it up, guys. Let Alan get some sleep.
Oh, do you know I actually can't even go to sleep? it's crazy. My wife and I have this thing. We get a pickup of these groceries from a farm. It's like a sort of a community farming thing.
Yeah.
So we have to pick that up after 5:30. So I actually can't go to sleep anyway. I realized that at 10:30 this morning, I laid down in bed and my wife goes, "What time is it?" I'm like, "You don't want to know." And then she's like, and I was like, "Listen," I was like, after always record, I'll just crash. It'll be okay. And then someone went, "Oh no, I can't sleep. We have to wait till 5:30. It's all right. This is a form of meditation for me, in a weird sort of way. You know, as people do all these sort of things to get into altered states, I find myself very comfortable in lack of sleep. It's sort of, as someone who had insomnia for many years, it's something that it's a familiar enough territory that I know how to navigate. But if you guys got to run, I wasn't trying to extend this just to say I appreciate you looking out for me, but there's no hope for me sleeping anytime soon.
Well, I actually have to run, and I'm actually recording. So as far as recorded material, this is where, unfortunately, we have to bid adieu. But
this was great. This was it's actually, I'm looking at the clock. We've been going at for 2 hours and 54 minutes. So
that's nothing for us. We sometimes go for like 5 hours, you know. But yeah,
not all of it makes it to the thing. But it's this thing, you know. You said you go down these rabbit holes, or the conversation just takes on a light. But this, you can't do this with everybody, and this is something that I just really appreciate, and I think this was absolutely wonderful. So I thank you for this. We can always sort of cut that little segment out. But is there anything you want to weave off on, or just
This was great. Yeah, I mean, it's you know what we were doing, which is fun, and I don't know how much, you know, like it's just fun to do, and just that thing. I don't know if it's, you know, we're tapping into the mystical noosphere, or whether we're just making little, you know, connections, you know. But anyway, this was great. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Thanks so much for joining us, Mike. It was a real pleasure.
Great, totally. Great. Yeah, this was fun.
Thank you.
Hey. We'll be right back.